that I still have to grow and need movement on and need to grow in. And it was a great lesson to me, an absolutely great lesson. And I cooked for about 3 years. I became a good cook. And, you know, another thing in making amends to my sons, my kids didn't care that I was writing and directing TV shows. They didn't give a crap about that. My son Jesse, when he was a little boy, was fascinated by cooking. He said, "Dad, will you teach me how to cook?" And this kid who was so scared of me, this kid who couldn't stop pretending that he was a robot, we'd go to the market and we'd see what was interesting and fresh, and we cook together. And it's something we still do now. We do these AA lunches for guys I sponsor and stuff, and Jesse loves to cook with me. I mean, that's something that just wouldn't have happened. Absolutely would not have happened, you know, had I not cooked for a living and had he not been attracted to that. And I cooked for about 3 years and got real good at it. The other thing that was really interesting was on a movie set, the director screams at the assistant director sometimes, and the assistant director will scream at the second assistant director. The second assistant director will scream at the third assistant director, and the third assistant director will say, "Where is that son of a bitch caterer?" Because I'm the only guy he can scream at. So then he'll come scream at me, and I got a kid 10 years younger than me screaming at me, and I'm thinking, you know, someday you'll come to meet your new boss, and it'll be me, and I'll make your entire life a living, breathing hell. I said this to myself, and I had to write a lot of inventory about this because I'd get beat up pretty good. And years later, when I wound up directing TV shows at Universal again, AD was brought in to meet his new boss, and it was me. And I looked at him, and I saw in his eyes him say, "Not the caterer. Oh, no, no, not the caterer." And I just saw his whole body kind of go. He just did this little shimmy kind of. And I didn't need it, but I got a kick out of it. And I... got a little enjoyment there, and and I didn't have to hurt the guy at all, but it was fun. And I was walking around the Universal lot at that time, and a grip on a TV show is a guy who makes everything possible, sets the shots up, and sets everything kind of you need for the shot. And it's an important job in that situation. And there was this one head grip there, and he saw me on the lot, and he went, "Oh, you're that caterer. You're such a sweet guy. What are you doing on the lot?" And I said, I'm directing the show on stage 46. And he said, "Did you go right from the catering to the directing? Was it better?" And I, "Yeah, you want to direct, get a catering job." And I cooked for about 3 years, and I got to really work step 10 and really enlarge my experience of the first five steps. And I at the end of the 3 years, I had an overture made to me by Ketchum Public Relations, this big PR company in New York, about doing a comedy writing PR job for them. And it involved food. It was kind of even more perfect for me because I had had this experience, you know. And they had me do a videotape. And I thought at this point, if I got this job, it would really benefit the guys I sponsor because they would see me suffer terribly and now again prosper thusly. Any sentence that includes the word thusly, I'm in bad shape. Anytime I edge into the biblical area at all, I'm in really, thusly is death for me. So I did this videotape for him, and I went mad. I mean, my brain blew up before. I mean, I was not living it today. The mind reading skills, everything, I went cuckoo. I had to sit down, write about it, release it, read it to my sponsor. And then shortly after I released the whole thing, I got a call from Ketchum Public Relations explaining that I didn't have the job, and I was fine with it. Shortly after that, I got a call from my catering company asking me to go to the mountains, Lake Arrowhead, which is in the mountains above L.A., to cater a commercial. I said, "Great." And I get up there with the truck, and I grab the call sheet, which gives you all the information about the commercial, and I see that the commercial is for Ketchum Public Relations. I'm feeding them now. Now I'm feeding them. And I look at the end of the truck, and there's a guy with a videotape camera, and he's taping me. I said, "What are you doing?" He said, "We're taping the making of the commercial." He's taping my humiliation. He's taping my humiliation. He's going to go back to New York with it, and he's going to show it to the guys, and they're going to go, "Is that Scott Redmond with the meatloaf? Oh, my God, that poor son of a bitch." I got home from the shoot, and I called my sponsor, and I said, Oh, we're really getting the gift now. It's
a miracle. This is just a miracle. Miracle, miracle, miracle.
And he said to me, I guess God had enough writers and he needed a few cooks today. And then he said, you told God you wanted to work for Ketchum and you forgot to tell him what you wanted to do. As long as they're having a good time, you know, guys? I subsequently wound up back in show business. I wound up writing screenplays and doing a lot of really great stuff and directing a lot of TV shows and into my fifth and sixth and seventh year of sobriety, through around 10 years of sobriety, and really for a long time. And then a couple of years ago, I was faced with making a career change, which was an incredibly painful, difficult thing for me. Because I had always, when I had gotten alternate work as a writer, I would get work with the understanding that if a writing job or a directing job presented itself, I would leave. That was all out front with my employer. And it was really clear for me, with two kids in college now, and my wife is a nursery school teacher, and the fact is our culture pays people more money to clean our toilets than it does to take care of our children. That's just the truth. That's the way, unfortunately, the way our society works, which is pretty sad. I'm not saying that we don't pay our people who clean our toilets, but we probably ought to pay the people who are taking care of our babies as much. And I'm really committed to being a member of a family where someone does that and doesn't make a lot of money. That's just one of my commitments to my marriage, you know, that I feel really comfortable with. And I had to change my career, and I was confronted with a tremendous amount of self-pity. Now, a lot of things had happened to me up until that point of time that facilitated this, and I want to talk about some of them. Some years ago, I talked at, what is it? It's Seaside, right? And while I was at Seaside, before I went to Seaside, what happened was this is a guy, a very, very powerful guy, extremely powerful, multimillionaire. Was a captain of industry, the head of his company, and he was sent by his company up to a rehabilitation center. And he called his brother from the rehabilitation center, and he said, "Look, I don't know how I'm going to do this, but I have heard a tape of a guy who this guy can get me sober. I know it. This guy will do it. I don't know how I'm going to get in touch with him. I don't know how I'm going to get a hold of him, but I got to meet this guy. This guy, Scott Redmond." And his brother said to him, "Scott Redden has been my sponsor for 10 years. You've eaten dinner with him about a dozen times. You stood next to him at my wedding. You have the mind of a chicklet. You're an idiot. And hold it, I'm sitting on Scott's lap now." You know. And he was in a rehab near Seaside. I spoke up at Seaside a month later. He was there. We met. We talked. It was my first time. It was the first time I think I met Terry, or we had, at any rate. But, and you know how long I kept this guy sober for? Exactly, not 1 second, not one solitary second. And this guy had resources beyond my wildest dreams. His friends took him and sequestered him on a privately owned Caribbean island to stay sober, and he stayed sober until the day he got off the Caribbean island. He went to any lengths and had the resources to truly go to any lengths to try to control and enjoy his drinking. And he got sicker and sicker and was pounded into the dirt, and his life was becoming unraveled. And one day he calls me and he says, "I got it. Come over. You got to see this, man. I got it." We were talking about this after the first session. He had a first edition copy of the Big Book, one of the red ones. There's a couple of hundred left. I think there's 500 or something that are still around. They're very pricey items. They go now from anywhere from $7,000 to $10,000 to $12,000. And he had one of the Big Books. He said, "I got it." And I opened it up. I said, it's perfect. He said, "I know." I said, "It doesn't even look like it's ever been read." He says, "It's perfect. I know." I said to him, "So you got the loser book. You got like the loser book that's been handed down from loser to loser for 65 years. Congratulations." That's just great. "And there's no helpful markings in here that will confuse you." things got so terrible for him, so awful, that eventually he couldn't find anything to hang himself from. So he tied a rope to his neck to something that was just sticking out of the wall and just sat down until he was dead. Because he had to turn the music off. He had to turn it off, you know. Our problem mainly rests in our mind. It's the good news and the bad news. I sponsor a guy named Phil, and I've been working with him for a long time. He was really a great guy. He had been through a lot. When I met him, he was living on the floor of his crack dealer's apartment. He had been a member of a punk rock band, and he was tremendously injured and damaged by the disease of alcoholism. When guys come to me and they ask me to sponsor them, I tell them that I will sponsor them, but that I'm not going to tell them what to do. And I'm going to walk towards God and work the steps with them. And if they don't want to do the work, ultimately, I'm a really boring guy to talk to. I just am. That's what I do. You know, if you want to talk about auto mechanics, I'm just like, if that's all you can talk about, that's not something I'm going to be able to do with you. And he came to me and he said, look, I've been going out with this woman for a couple of months, and she's pregnant. And I think we want to get married and have the baby. What do you think? And I didn't even know he was going out. You know, it was one of those, who? It was, just, you know, and I said to him, I took a breath and I said, I tell you what, if you want to get an abortion, I'll lend you the money and drive you over there. And if you want to get married, I'll be the best man at the wedding. And I meant it. I didn't think that. I had another opinion of what he was doing and what might be a better idea to do, but I held that in abeyance and followed through on my commitment to him. They got married. I was the best man at the wedding. They had a baby, and the baby was born near death and was terribly injured. They did a house birth. The baby was born blue and stayed blue. They rushed it to a hospital. It was connected to something called an ECMO machine, a horribly invasive process where they actually go into the baby's body, detach the aorta, connect it to a machine, take the blood out of the body, oxygenate it, and put it back in the body of a newborn baby. It doesn't really get much more invasive and alarming than that. And this baby hung near death for days, and she was in neonatal intensive care, and the AA Army showed up. Now, you can't go to neonatal intensive care unless you're a relative. So her relative showed up. Big black Ethiopian men, small Japanese women, and overweight Jews. And it was so funny because after a while, the nurses would just go, yeah, you're an aunt. Yeah, you're the grandmother. Go ahead. You know, I mean, it was just unbelievable. And the call went out for blood. They needed blood. And 3 weeks after Phil and the family was home again, the hospital called Phil and said, look, they're still coming with blood. They're like dropping it off in jars. They're like, these people are nuts. You know, you really ought to talk to them. And most of us can't even give blood. We've either got fresh tattoos or ex-hypes, you know, or we're fresh tattoos with hypes or whatever. But I mean, but you still go and you ask, you know, you go and you check it out and you try. And Phil pulled me aside once the baby was safe, and the baby is now an incredible, gorgeous 6-year-old girl. Named Cassidy. And Phil pulled me aside and he said, when you told me that in the car, I didn't believe you. I didn't believe you until you came to the hospital every day and visited my kid. The thing that Phil doesn't know, or maybe he doesn't know, but it doesn't matter, is that I went to that hospital for him and I went to the hospital for the kid. But the thing is I walked into that hospital and felt the presence of my father every day I went in there. I couldn't show up the night he died, but I could go see Cassidy every day and talk to her and feel the presence of my father and know that I had a relationship with him again, that he loved me, and that I wasn't the guy who couldn't show up. Now, again, I didn't do it as a frontal assault. I made a commitment to a guy. I told him I would help him. I followed through on the promise. Part of the promise was going to the hospital, and I go to the hospital. I couldn't even hear the sound of a heart machine because it sounded like a personal indictment of my collapse as a son and a man. But I go to Cassidy's house, which is this hospital now, and I know that Davy Redmond adores him. And I know that it was alcoholism that had me be who I was, and I'm not anymore. I'm just not, you know. And I don't know what that is for you. I don't know what that black hole is for you. If you're new, I don't know what it is for you that makes you feel like you've been just blindsided by a brick, just whacked right in the side of the face. But these experiences early on for me of taking that commitment to my higher power, following through on them, and finding the ice fall away from my heart, finding that I had my father back into my life, that I was able eventually to show up for guys the day that they died and hold them during their death rattle and give them a kiss and take the first three steps with them and work step 6 and 7 and 11. And my friend Jim, who died in my arms, I sponsored him for 6 years, turned to a guy by the side of the bed and said, "I'm okay and I'm sober," and he made... took his light into another room. That when my sponsor Paul died a year ago, a couple of days before he died, and I sat in a hospital bed, I came into the hospital room, and the nurse is taking his blood pressure, and she said, "Your blood pressure's up." And he said, "I know." And he pointed to me, he said, "He excites me." Just such an incredible guy. And we sat in that room about 48 hours before he died, and we talked about what a successful relationship we had had, how we took pleasure in one another's happiness, what a good time we had had, how well we had done with each other, what a good communication we had had. And that has been the model for me to have a successful marriage. I have two wonderful questions here, which I want to talk about as I wrap this up this morning. I guess it was about 4 or 5 years ago, somebody just reminded me of it in the room. Somebody had called Nancy and I to do a retreat together, and we agreed to do it, and we called the guy back a couple of months later, and we said, "We're going to get divorced. Unless you want a divorce workshop, we're really not the people to do this." And we canceled it, and it was really the smart thing to do. And we have had... And the question is, what specifically did you do to improve your relationship with your wife over the last 6 years? I'm resentful at my wife for telling me I'm a pig. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, ambition, personal relations, and sex. What are the defects of character? I'm a pig. Now, I wouldn't write them... I wouldn't write I'm a pig because that's name calling, okay? What I am is I'm irresponsible. I'm a bully. I use the, you know, I say to you very grandiosely and beautifully that I support a woman who does work with kids, but have I hung it over her head and said, "You know what? I'm making money. I don't do dishes." You bet your ass I have. Have I blackmailed her with it? Let's pull back away from the spiritual God I was 20 minutes ago and tell you, yes, I had, and it had to go on in inventory. So those are the defects of character about being irresponsible around the house. I'm resentful at my wife for punishing me by withholding sex. It affects my self-esteem, pocketbook, and ambition, personal relations. Sex, what are the defects of character? Lust. Now, lust is an interesting defect. It's the same as gluttony. Gluttony is an interesting defect, too. Being hungry is not being gluttonous. Hunger plus power equals gluttony. Hunger plus shame or plus... I want more for me and less that, which unfortunately is going to mean less for you. The minute that I attach power, like shame or guilt or aggression, to the hunger, then it becomes a defect. There's nothing wrong with being sexual or wanting to have sex, but the minute it gets anchored or moored to power, it becomes a defect. I want to have sex no matter how you feel. So I've got to find some gray area. My ideal on some days is to have a mattress strapped to my wife's back so I can just push her over at will when the feeling comes over me so that we can be serviced properly. Wasn't as bad as some of the other things I've said this morning. I'm resentful at my wife for I'm resentful of my wife for being not attractive in the way I want her to be attractive or sexy or forthcoming as I like her to be. What are the defects? Well, I'm irresponsible because I'm watching a lot of pornography, and I want to tell you there's very few living people who can compete with someone who's got a hairstylist and makeup person sitting by the side of the bed. It's almost impossible. My wife's never lit that well. I personally have no problem with pornography. people can use it, do whatever they want with it. I can even participate in pornography once in a while, but if I'm doing it all the time, I can't, for me personally, this works different ways for different guys. I can't expect a living, breathing human being to compete in that arena. It just can't. Some guys, it's like a good aid. For me, it's not a good aid. For me, it's a bad reminder. I don't even know what that means, but believe me, it's true. So I can't expect to have a successful experience with my wife if I'm continuing to engage in that behavior on that kind of level. This kind of inventory work led me to actions that made me available for a better relationship with my wife. Now, there's a stopgap, and members of Al-Anon and people who are familiar with Al-Anon literature will know what I'm talking about specifically. That doesn't mean my wife is going to become a willing, loving participant in some kind of equal give-and-take relationship, which is now I'm trying to get myself ready to participate in by doing all this inventory work. Because I'm resentful at her for not wanting sex enough. I'm resentful at myself for not being sexually attractive enough. I'm resentful. I've got all these resentments. So I'm working on. I'm doing the inventory. And I'm working with other guys who are experiencing sexual problems that are just making my eyes reel. I mean, just, you know, I don't want to talk about it, but I mean, without the 12 step, without the 10 step, there's no 12 step, and without the 12 step, there's much less gratitude in my life, because I got guys who are going through stuff involving trapezes, and, you know, I just, at any rate. Now, members of Al-Anon know that you can live happily, joyously, and freely with active alcoholism. There are plenty of people in Al-Anon, incredible examples. One of my favorite Al-Anon speakers, the first time she went to meet her sponsor, she went to her house and the sponsor's husband was lying drunk on the floor of the entranceway of the house and the screen door was opening and closing on his head. and her sponsor said from in the house, "Oh, just step on over here, him, and come on in." So she had just learned how to live happy, joyous, and free with active alcoholism. And we also know that the answer might be to get out of the alcoholic situation and get away from it, that it's not okay, that it's not a safe, not a prosperous place for a person to be. So once I come up to bat, spiritually fit, then I have a choice. If my partner is going to remain entrenched and intransient and not willing to play, then I have a choice. Am I going to learn to live happy, joyously, and freely and stay in that situation and be happy, joyous, and free no matter what that other person does? Or am I going to reach a point where I say, you know what? I want to be on deck with this. I want to have a sexually active, participating situation. Now, that's a choice I can't make for anybody. It's a choice I made for myself. I reached a point in my marriage where I said, I either have to have this in my life or I don't want to be here. And that's when for Nancy and I happened to be with someone who felt the same way. I happened to be with someone who said, yeah, I can't bear this agony anymore. And part of that, my sponsor used to say, do you want to be right or you want to be happy? That's something that we've heard a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous and was unbelievably effective and practical for me in my relationship. Because if I withhold a certain amount of stuff, you will be reminded that you are wrong. You are wrong, you must be punished, and this must be pointed out as often as I can possibly remember. And if I remain intransigent, sometimes I would picture Nancy and I like two kids on opposite ends of a sandbox with just nobody willing to come to the middle to play. My sponsor used to say, sometimes the longest journey you'll ever make is the 2 feet to the other side of the bed. Man, was that true. And once we in desperation, absolute desperation, started entering in a prayer regimen together. And again, and right now what we do is I read in the morning, my wife will read for me Courage to Change from Al-Anon. Al-Anon literature has been so helpful to me. And I'll read to her from one of my meditation books, sometimes an OA meditation book, which I read every morning. And it's been an incredible exchange of ideas and loving ways to show how we mold our day. But the thing that's been most important is for us to hold hands and say, Father, please, can you help me to stop taking everything personally? You know, One of the things, and I learned this with my kids, it was an incredible lesson for me. I would not let my children finish fights. I felt so guilty about what an awful father I was. When they'd start to fight, I'd pull them apart. And Nancy, because she was a gifted teacher, would say, please, you're never letting them stop, which was the story of my marriage. Every time we'd start to fight about the same thing, I'd go, how did we wind up here again? We never leave here. We never leave here. We should just furnish here and be here because we never get out of here. It's the same material. And the fact is my kids never stopped fighting because they never finished. So Nancy said, Scott, you're not letting them finish. I started letting them finish. And they finished. They would finish. They're boys. They'd come up with something else, you know, in a little while. But they got the sense of finishing. And what my wife started doing with me is I'd start to scream, and she'd let it go, and then she'd take a breath and say, okay, let's start this again. Or I'd start to get depressed and mope and become an inanimate object, and which is the tyranny of helplessness. I'm fine with both again. And she'd take a breath. And what we started to do was learn how to finish fights. Learn how to finish fights so we didn't have this sense of hopeless recidivism, where we were back in the same place every time. So those are a few of the things that Nancy and I have done very specifically, predicated for me starting with the inventory and then going into a relationship where we're really both willing. I think that if there's not willingness on both parts, I think it's really difficult unless you make a decision that it's okay, like living with active alcoholism, that you'll stay there. The other thing that has been key for me, and I'm not going to do it during this workshop, but if you haven't done it already, I want to urge you to do it, is to study the traditions. Study the traditions and take a look at them and apply them to your relationship as a group. You know, the group comes before the individual. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be part of the marriage. You know, we hire professionals to do professional jobs that thing we have about that service positions will pay for, you know, but our 12-step work is never to be paid for. Well, that means that if I do things in my marriage and act like a husband, I can't blackmail you with them. But things that are extraordinary that should be paid for should get normal payment. That's a really interesting one. There's a way to apply each individual tradition as a tool for your marriage. And I have found that to be tremendously helpful. Tremendously helpful. Great question. Second question. I have been 16 years. I have blank years of sobriety, but have not had a sponsor for a number of years and now feel like I need one. But how does someone who knows it all find the right qualities in a sponsor? Well, I'm going to talk a great deal tomorrow about my relationship with my first sponsor who I had for 10 years because it really leads me into the discussion of forgiveness. But I had a sponsor after him for almost 5 years named Paul. So Paul died. I'm Scott Redmond, circuit speaker. Care for a tape? Take two tapes. Call me in the morning. I'm in trouble. I'm in real trouble. How can I be sponsored? How can I be sponsored? Who gets the honor of sponsoring me? I mean, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. Why can't I be sponsored? And, I've been saying this to men I sponsor for years and years. Are you willing to sponsor? Are you willing to allow yourself to be sponsored? Okay, this is one of the weirdest diseases in the world. We don't have to let anyone help us. You don't. You can decline help. You don't have to be helped. But if I invite someone into my life, if I find somebody that I can tell everything to, if I have a guy who I can tell everything to, who I trust, who I love. So what basically happened to me is I know what I got from Paul. I know what I got from Paul that was huge for me. I didn't get any AA mechanics from Paul. I had my mechanics in my first 10 years. I learned them great. I learned the inventory process great. I learned how to sponsor great. I didn't need any help with the mechanics of Alcoholics Anonymous. What Paul had done for me was he grew me up spiritually. Anybody who says this is the way AA is, and that's it, is not familiar with any of the historical material on Alcoholics Anonymous. The guys who founded this were deranged nuts. They were yo-yos. They were sitting up with Ouija boards. They were taking niacin. Bill dropped a lot of acid until people said, you know, Bill, you're playing with a headless doll under a black light. You probably should lighten up a little bit. And I love that story about Bill and acid. It's in Pass It On. If you haven't read it, there's a whole chapter on it. I love it. These Canadian doctors called Bill and said, we believe you're right. That a spiritual experience is necessary to arrest alcoholism. And we have something that we feel will hasten that process. Lois was dropping it too. God bless her little soul. And Bill went back to the doctors and said, what I believe is, what? If you didn't hear him, someone just said, wow. He did. He really liked the stuff, and he totally agreed with them. Unfortunately, he then found out what we all know, which is it wears off. It wears off. You come down. And acid does change you, but not changes you like you need to be changed here. So what Paul did for me, because I was, and it was funny, we had a great talk outside about, I said something this morning about if I have to quit AA in order to join my home group, I don't want to ever have to do that. And a guy and I had a great talk about it. What I meant by that is I was in a home group that had become, for me and with me, really spiritually prideful. We were just doing it a little better than the other people in AA. And what that makes for me, it makes it almost impossible for me to attend other AA meetings because they're not doing it right. So I sit there and just judge my brains out. I'm not hearing anything. I'm just hearing Scott Redmond white noise. You know, wrong, wrong. Can't work the steps that way. I mean, it's a bad game show. It's Satan's game show. It doesn't work. And so what I was saying with that turn of phrase was, if my home group has set itself aside from AA by being a little more betterish, a little more goodish, and if I'm going to have to leave AA to join the group, I don't want to have anything to do with the group. And that's what was happening to me during that period of time before I started working with Paul. And Paul was a seeker. Paul just was a seeker. He would call me and say, look, I read this book. You got to take a look at it. Or I heard these tapes, man. This is great stuff. He was always just blowing it open, expanding it. His obsession was, and he wrote a book. If you ever get a chance, I don't know if Terry, do you have any copies of the book? Or you're going to get them probably? Yeah. Yeah, it is going back in the brain. It's called More Than You. There's more to quitting drinking than quitting drinking, and there's particularly sections on relationships. Again, non-conference approved literature. It's I love reading it because I gotta get to hear my sponsor talk again. So what I'm building up to here is I went through all of this bull about who is going to sponsor me and what's going to happen, and it's this big deal. And then I realized, and I gotta tell you, this is a great thing for me to talk about because I only realized it about 3 weeks ago. I said, what do you want, Scott? What do you want out of sponsorship? What was so comforting to you? And I said, growing up spiritually, stretching spiritually, knowing somebody who was involved in AA and who was using AA and other tools to expand what they were doing. Paul was the guy who brought me to the Sermon on the Mount, and I knew exactly who that was. I knew exactly who that was. It was a guy who I've heard a lot of times share about problems in sobriety. Some guys don't have any problems in sobriety. I got no beef with them. I also tend to not really learn much from them because I have a lot of problems in sobriety. I need solutions. And I only get that from guys who said, you know what, I almost got divorced and this is what's happened. Or I got divorced and that was really good. And this is the way I got through it sober and this is the way I get to pass this on, you know. So that's what's happened to me, and that's how I found the guy who I've just started working with. And I must tell you, I'm just so thrilled to be sponsored again. It's been a year, and it's too long for me. I love sponsoring guys, and I love that feeling of being taken care of telling my stuff to somebody, you know? And he's a guy... I don't like talking to people who don't listen. They wait to talk. You know what I mean? I was like that for years. I would never listen. I just wait to talk. And you can tell it with a guy. They still have, you know, a lot of rapid eye movement. you know, when you're trying to. It's like the same thing when you ask somebody how they are as you're walking away from them. Hi, how are you? I should really try to answer them. Well, you know, kind of pursue them. At any rate, that's certainly something I've done too. So I wanted to talk today. I feel like I, at least for myself, reached my goal. I really did talk about problems in sobriety, about talking about where I'm stuck, about talking about maybe passing on or discussing some tools that I've used to do that, which have generated out of step 10. And tomorrow I'm going to talk about 11 and 12, and we'll do we're going to do this little piece on forgiveness. Coming out of that, I have another sheet that I'm going to pass out to everybody, and I just can't tell you how much I love you guys and love being here, and have enjoyed the workshops this morning. I've really gotten a tremendous amount out of it, and if you are a Portland Trailblazer fan, I think that this is a great opportunity for you to demonstrate the power of God in your life and become loving Laker fans, and to forgive, okay? I love you guys. Let's stand and say the Lord's Prayer, and we'll get out of here. My name's Scott Redman. I'm an alcoholic. Morning, my friends. I handed out two sheets of paper. One's a statement on sponsorship, and one's a prayer thing, which I want to touch on briefly this morning. And are there any extras or any of that stuff? Great. Could you bring them up to me? I'd appreciate it. I actually need I need a copy of each one. I don't have one.
Keep one copy of each for Scott if you would.
If I need it actually now. I want. We're going to talk briefly about step 11. Talk about step 12. You know what? We're not going to. I'm going to. I just realized that I'm going to be doing the talking, and I can't start referring to myself as we, or I'm in really bad shape. And then we're going to talk about this whole issue of forgiveness. I hope that I know that some people have already read this the copy of the forgiveness section from Emmett Fox's book, and I'm going to be reading aloud from it this morning, so you don't have to have read it in order to participate. I wanted to start off this morning's session by talking about how I made the initial amends to my father and how that grew. As I told you about, I had been loaded on heroin the night that he died, and it had become an absolute nightmare for me. I couldn't talk about him or look at him. I had no pictures of him in our house. Every time I even thought about him, it would be like getting smashed in the face with a brick. It was just this black hole for me. And again, I didn't know what I was going to do about it. He was on my 8-step list, and I didn't know what I was going to do about it. I entertained the idea of writing a letter to him, of visiting his grave, and I couldn't get any relief from those things. I sponsor men who do that. I love and respect men who do that, and it works for them, and I have no call on that. I wished I could have done it. I was scared that I was never going to be free of this thing because I couldn't do it. And I had a sponsor who once again said, you know what, do your job in Alcoholics Anonymous. See what happens. Just do your job. And when I was in my first year of sobriety, I was on a line to get to buy lunch, and there was a guy in front of me. He was buying a can of Colt 45 malt liquor with, like, you know, a couple of pennies and lint and a half-eaten milk dud, you know, whatever he had in his pocket. You know the guy, right? And he turned around, and I'm looking at him. He said, what are you looking at? And instead of my best Bronx, I usually say nothing, you know. I said, how you doing? He said, you don't know how I'm doing. Nobody knows how I'm doing except for the people in AA. So we went outside, we talked, we exchanged numbers, and that night I went on my first real 12-step call. I called a guy with more time than me because that's what they told me to do. And we called the guy. We didn't know where to take this guy. I didn't know it, but the guy I called had never really done this kind of 12-step call either. He just had more time than me. And we were told to take him down to County General Hospital in L.A., a very, very luxurious and glamorous place. And we were told by these people to take him down and dump him off at the door. Don't walk him in. Don't show these people that he has any resources. Just take him and dump him off at the door. But we didn't. I couldn't even tell you why. We went all the way up to the alcoholic ward with this guy. And about halfway through, the guy I'm with, he turns to us and he says, I feel like I'm dying. And the guy that I'm with looks at him and goes, that's because you are. And I pulled the guy aside. I said, how could you say that to him? I'm worried he's not going to like us, you know? How can you say that to him, man? That is so cold. Now, what is the guy supposed to say to the guy? The guy is there. He's been told to lie that he's got blood in his urine to break into an alcoholic ward of a county facility. What is the guy supposed to say? Uh-oh, you're just having a bad day. This is just a bad day. This isn't a bad day. This is what dying feels like. I'll let you know when you're having a bad day. This isn't it. Some years later, I was sponsoring a guy who called me up one day, and he said, look, if you can fit it into your busy day, drop dead, all right? I want you off my back. I don't want to hear any more about this God crap or this book crap. Take your book and blow up. And then he proceeded to rip off some people in AA. He stole some money, stole a car, ripped off an apartment. He was making me look pretty bad. And I wanted to sit him down and explain a few things to him. And my sponsor said, you know what? You have so frightfully abused your right to tell people where they stand in the universe, you have lost it. Why don't you sit down and write, I'm resentful at blank for ripping people off in AA and making me look bad. It affects everything. Affected everything for me. What are the defects in me that if God would remove the resentment would be gone? I'm self-centered. You know, selfish, self-centered, and self-seeking are the same, but they're different. They're all about self, but they've got their own little spin on the ball. Selfish is wanting it all for me. Self-seeking is trying to figure out what's in it for me. And self-centered is figuring it's all about me. So they're the same, but they've got a little different spin on them all, you know? And I like to be as specific as I can when I talk to God about what I'm asking him to do. It's just very helpful to me, you know? So I was making it all about me. I didn't drink. I didn't rip people off. He did. I'm a people pleaser. I care more about how I'm seen in AA than this guy, than this guy's life. I'm making it about me. I've got spiritual pride. That's a new one. I didn't have that till I came into AA and became a spiritual Goliath, right? How dare a man comport himself thusly after coming into contact with a man of my spiritual caliber? It's hard to believe. I'm a retaliator and a character assassin. I've put him down to other people and I've attacked him in my mind. I'm playing God and I'm not trusting in God. And instead of telling this guy what I thought of him, I wrote the resentment. I moved on with the business of life and went and tried to help another guy. And some months after this event, this guy called me and he had found out he had a fatal illness and he was dying and he had called the city agency and they said, look, all we can do is take you down to county general and dump you off at the door. I knew that wasn't true because I had done my job in Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew I didn't have to do that. And everybody else around him had either told him what they had thought of him or he had burnt them out. I was the only guy he could call because I had kept my mouth shut. So I got to be there for a guy during his death when I couldn't be there for my father. And my father started coming back into my life. And he didn't come back as a burning bush or an event. I just felt, starting from that point forward, I felt less pain when I thought of him. I felt less of this. It was a war of attrition. Again, my disease does not react well to a frontal assault. It started becoming unraveled. And then more revelations followed. I realized that my sons had no relationship with my father because it was too painful for me to tell stories about him. So I got a picture of him. I put a picture of him in my house. So a really handsome man, you know. And I started telling my sons stories about my pop. And they have a relationship now with their grandfather that they never had, that I would have denied them of. And all sorts of things developed out of that. All sorts of freedoms. All sorts of freedoms around parents, around authority with my kids. My son, I live with a bunch of deranged anarchists. They're all commies. They're nuts. I mean, I failed to tell you, my wife, I met my wife, I got her on the rebound from a Marxist commune in in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And she's raised these two little commies. You know, they go to Sandinista summer camp, for God's sake. And they really should not be allowed to talk to each other. They get each other going, and they wind up on airplanes. I mean, they're really cuckoo and a lot of fun. It's like living in a psychological theme park. I mean, it's really wild, just wild. And and scary sometimes, too. And Michael is about 12 years old. And, you know, now that I'm a sober man and I'm in my life and I'm living, you know, I used to talk all sorts of long crap and I didn't do anything. And part, since I started addressing my inventory as my spiritual assignment, I give money to candidates that I believe in. I kick in money to causes that I believe in. It's a great feeling for me. I really love to do it. At any rate, because of this, my father-in-law was over at the house. My father-in-law is an arch conservative. It's a lot of fun when everyone gets together. And my son's a 12-year-old kid, and he's just espousing all of this, you know, apocalyptic stuff, you know. And my father-in-law tells my son the big lie. Here's the big lie. And it's, you know what, it's just like Henry James says, it's you cannot argue with this. Condemnation prior to investigation, you cannot argue with this statement. He said, you know, I felt that way when I was your age, but when you get older, you won't feel that way anymore. And I just saw it put a pin in my kid. I just saw him just go like this. It was awful, you know. And my sons trust me and they know I walk like I talk. They've been watching, you know, they watch. And my father-in-law left the house, and I said to the boys, come inside. Come inside, and they sit down, and I said, your grandpa just lied to you. He has no idea that that's true. And I want to tell you that not only do I believe basically the same stuff that I believed during the 60s, now I'm kind of coughing up some dough. I'm actually putting my money where my mouth is. I have found that what he has said to you is patently untrue. And I saw my kids just like come up to it, you know? It was beautiful. And I didn't have to say your grandfather's a moron. I just said what I believe is the truth. I think he told them an untrue thing in order to win a fight. I don't think he fought good. He could have said, you know, this might change. That would have been something, but that wasn't what he did. So I just wanted to talk a little bit more about how I started that amends process with my father, and then it developed more and more, and I was able to show up for other guys during their death and do stuff like visit that baby in the hospital. And now when I'm in the hospital on a 12-step call, I feel a freedom and a sense of renewal and a connection to my father that is really profound, really profound. That was certainly not in the books for me. There was no way that was going to happen. I want to move in on and briefly touch on step 11. On this handout I've handed out, I've given you basically what's my structure for my morning prayers. It might be of some help to you, and it also might be of just complete not help to you at all. But I just wanted to share with you that in the morning I say, I am powerless, my life is unmanageable, I know that you will restore me to sanity, I turn my will and my life over to you. Those are the first two steps. And the third step, I say the third step prayer, I say the seven step prayer. And what I've done here in this little paragraph is I've put together a list of things which I'm basically told to ask God for in the 11th step in the big book of AA. I say, Father, please direct my thinking today. Show me all through the day what my next step is to be. Give me whatever I might need to overcome such difficulties. Please keep my thoughts especially divorced from selfish, dishonest, and self-seeking motives. Keep me from self-will and self-pity. Hold me close to you, reveal your work to me, and give me the power to carry it out. Hold me close to you, and keep me sober just for today, so that I might better do thy will be done, not mine. I love the description of the 11th step in the big book of AA, and I have found myself implementing the 11th step in many, many ways. I started a back treatment recently. I've had a chronic bad back, and I started doing this a thing called Feldenkrais. It's called the Feldenkrais program, and it's become not only a source of great comfort for my physical malady, but another great source of meditation. I have a sponsor who has led me to people like Anthony DeMello, who's really interesting Jesuit priest who has this series of tapes called Waking Up. I'm not suggesting any of these things. I'm just telling you that I want to be like Bill and the Ouija board. I want to be one of those guys. I want to be a seeker. I want to keep pushing it. I just want to keep pushing it. It's all got to be couched on the platform of AA for me. It all has to. I don't sit and meditate for 30 minutes a day. You know, I do little meditations as the day goes by. But the reason why I'm talking about the 10th step this weekend, the reason why I'm going to talk about forgiveness is when I first started working with my sponsor, Paul, I asked him who his favorite speaker was. And he mentioned this guy to me who I had never heard. I said, who's he? And Paul said, oh, he gave a great talk right up until the day he drank and died. And what had happened to the guy is he had become unteachable. He had become unteachable. He had become a speaker. He had started to declaim and became pedantic and didactic and stopped offering himself up to his higher power the way I just need to keep doing it. And the 11th step has been a great source. I don't want to spend too much time on it this morning because I want to move on to forgiveness, but I just wanted to mention to you a couple of the tools that I've used and this little prayer that I put together out of the section on the 11th step. By the way, it's an interesting thing. My favorite rendering of the 11th step in the big book is actually in Bill's story. He talks about it very, very beautifully. He says, never was I to pray for myself except on, as my request bore on my usefulness to others. This is the bottom of 13. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. My friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were essential to these essential requirements. And this I love. Simple but not easy. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over all. Step 12 is the reason that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and that I've done all this work. I've heard AA referred to in the press as a self-help program. I can't even imagine a less appropriate description of Alcoholics Anonymous. This is as antithetical and dialectically opposed to the notion of self-help that you can possibly get. It couldn't be less self-help. Most newcomers I know are shit magnets. If there's any shit in the universe, it seems to find them and just glom onto them. I have found that was really true for me. It seemed like if there was any crap just out there in the ether, somehow it either appeared in my pocket or in the form of a burning bag on my front step. So I also think, you know, that and it's funny, you know, we hear the phrase, let us love you until you can love yourself. That's never really worked for me. I thought that if you loved me, you were either deranged or stupid. You know, one of the two. Except on the days where you couldn't possibly love me enough, you know. Somebody asked a question which I really enjoyed. He wrote down, do you have any experience with a higher power outage of feeling of doing the work but not a sense of God or feeling or God in your life? And my answer is that one thing that was very important for me to find out in sobriety is that God is not a feeling. That again is a frontal assault to me. God is not a feeling. I feel something when I have God, but God is not a feeling. Because if God is a feeling, then he's a drug. And I know how to get that. I know how to do that all the time. You know those rats, they had that experiment where they did rats where they got to push a button and their pleasure center would go off. And all of them were dead the next day. My kind of rat, you know. it's just my kind of rat, man. And the thing I have found that if I Alcoholics Anonymous is a design for living, and it's a prescription of spiritual work steeped in action that will produce a spiritual experience if applied diligently and long enough, and if you continue to abstain from the substances that will make that will not facilitate that, will make it impossible. That gall darn not drinking part again. You know, a lot of people want our deal, but it's that gall darn not drinking thing. Our ranks would swell if it wasn't for that not drinking thing. You know, I guarantee you, it would be hard to get a seat in an AA meeting. So I think that it's, you know, I've talked to many guys who get concerned when they're doing stuff and they feel like they're just going through the motions. One thing that I like to do is very much like the 10-step process that I discussed yesterday, that if I'm really not being feeling fulfilled, is number one, to have reasonable expectations of my relationship with God. And again, God is, it's not a feeling. I can't measure it with a feeling. I think my feelings are overrated. I really do. I think I've overrated them time and time again. Don't get me wrong. I have to be in a situation and have relationships where I can express them and have them dealt with. I really do. But when I say they're overrated, they just ran my life. I went wherever the emotional weather vane went, man. That's where I was, you know? So one thing I'd like to do when I repeat resentments is go back to the first five propositions. And one thing I like to do when I'm experiencing perhaps... if I'm doing service and I'm sponsoring guys and I'm grinding my teeth, then there's something wrong. If I'm grinding my teeth for too long, the 12th step is perfect. It's absolutely perfect. I believe Alcoholics Anonymous is a perfect program being delivered by imperfect people. I just do, you know. So I would go to the 11th step and say, okay, where am I? What am I not doing here? Do I need to push it? Do I need to enlarge? Is this becoming mechanical? Because the 10th step can become mechanical. Do I need to expand here? And that's another thing that my sponsor Paul did for me, and my present sponsor. I want to read a brief thing, one of the last things that my sponsor Paul wrote and emailed to me. And I took out the heading on the email. He wrote to me, he said, here's part of something I've been working on. It's just something that had come up for him and he wanted to put down on paper and he shot it off to me. He said, be an interested observer. Have you ever watched the continuing deterioration of someone you really want to help? Perhaps a close friend or relative, maybe one or more of your own children, and they don't respond to anything you say or do. This can be extremely frustrating and discouraging for people in recovery. You want so badly to help, but you can't. They just don't hear you. They do not respond to unsolicited advice or counsel. This happens to me when I try too hard in sponsoring, when I am working harder on their recovery than they are. It happens to people who have heard about the highly directive, dictatorial type of sponsor and want to be like that, but discover that the sponsee simply ignores them. In a situation like this, I assume the role of interested observer. Rather than becoming annoyed at them and at sponsorship in general, I become an interested but inactive observer. I listen. I'm interested in what they are doing, but how it is going to turn out. And I answer an occasional question, but mainly I observe. I see myself as sitting quietly in the audience rather than projected into the action on the screen. Since I have no investment in the outcome, I'm not emotionally involved in making it come out my way. As a result, I'm comfortable and entertained rather than frustrated and resentful. Indeed, I am practicing the AA principle, love and tolerance of others is our code. And one more time, I realize that if I want to change my feelings, I must first change my actions and my thinking. Mine, not theirs. I can't let their behavior be more important to me than my emotional sobriety, my serenity. No matter how much I love them, no matter how much I care about them, no matter how important their welfare is to me, I must watch my priorities. I must value my serenity ahead of their behavior.